Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What the fucksters? What the fuckinucks? Yeah, the what the fuckinucks. Why not? I'm in Canada still, so that seems appropriate. How's it going? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, broadcasting from a hotel room, but it's nice. It's not a bad hotel room. It's more of a residence-style hotel room. I think it's actually an apartment. You could definitely live here. You could live anywhere, really. I mean, and I'm in Canada. So there's reflection going on. I do want to say that, I want to thank certainly the journalists of the world and also the entertainers of the world for being one of the only, sadly, truly functional checks on this presidency. So that being said, I have Stephen Colbert on the show today. Stephen and I go back a bit. We don't know each other that well. I've done his show several times, but we sort of started in the same world. And, he has risen to the occasion for personal reasons, for reasons of whatever it is. You know, Stephen is one of the guys who is publicly pushing back through humor, but also through anger and heart and concern and fear on a nightly basis. Against this sort of wave of authoritarian thinking and single-party minority rule supporters, anti-Americans who consider themselves to be making America great again. Stephen is sort of a hero in the fight in a way, because he's able to present information and anger in a humorous way, providing some comfort to the sort of ongoing internal and cultural current of fear and apprehension and not knowing what's going to happen, and keeps people from tipping off the edge, because a lot of people are falling off the edge mentally and in a lot of other ways, because this shit is hard and it's scary, and that's where we're at. And Stephen is one of the guys that makes it funny, so I was happy to talk to him. We had a tight talk, because I had to go over to the theater, the Ed Sullivan Theater, and pull him away from the daily grind of hosting a daily show. And he gave me about an hour, and he's a talker, and we I think we did all right. So that's happening. That you can look forward to that in a few minutes. I'm getting a lot of emails from people about many things. Hundreds of emails about the Eve Ensler episode from men and women. Almost equal, oddly, and just from people who are victims, parents of victims, victims by proximity, people who have been destroyed from abuse and domestic and sexual violence and just situations. It's just overwhelming, really, and I've been getting a lot of emails relative to anti-Semitism. I've been getting emails to add to the conversation around addiction and recovery, just emails of fear, in terms of managing it. I had no idea that my conversations would lead to some sort of to help. I really got into this trip to try to get something going, and I guess to engage myself, and whatever my process has been over time has had an effect on people, and it's humbling, I'm glad to help out. So I hope you're doing okay. I hope your life is going well, and you got that thing done, or you fixed that thing, or you got that thing looked at, or you got your kid into the right place, and whatever. I just hope. There's emails here about the creeping authoritarianism that seems to be honestly happening in America, despite the presses or all of our best efforts to sort of feel like there's something we can do to engage, and obviously there is, but it's happening, and it's good. As I've kind of been trying to grow myself to kind of really know who you are and who's in charge of your brain and how do you handle what you think and how do you facilitate some sort of change in yourself and in the world. So the emails, obviously I get hundreds of these and there's a selection process here that's kind of random, but I'm trying to focus. Subject line, Fantasyland. I've been talking about that book. Mark, I grew up in the Pentecostal charismatic movements described in Fantasyland, specifically the offshoots of John Wimber's Vineyard. It was partly my upbringing in that environment that led me to some really crazy cult-like groups. After I got out of my last group about 5 years ago and started to get healthy, I began listening to WTF, the stories of your guests with all their ups and downs, false starts, and long droughts of non-work, usually ending in some type of success story, usually, helped keep me grounded as I began the process of rebuilding different parts of my life. Your story, too, of finding success later in life, especially after living in your own drug-fueled fantasy land, is continually encouraging. And just so you know, I'm doing well now. I love your little allusions to Fantasyland in your recent episodes, like bringing up Celebration, the Disney Town, and the Jamie Dembo interview. The book helped give me a context to my upbringing and the groups I was involved in that was incredibly insightful and healing. Listening to you and Kurt hash it out over a couple hours would be a real treat. You got to bring them on. I'll try, Paul. I'll try. But I like this idea that you bring up, Paul. I like the idea of helped give me a context to my upbringing and the groups I was involved with. See, like, I don't think I fully realize all the time that sometimes just a little bit of personal experience shared or a little bit of information can completely change the way you see or contextualize something in both positive and negative ways, depending on your emotional disposition at that moment or who you are. But there is a power to conversation. There is a power to sort of experience. And there is a power to sort of educating yourself around these things to give context, because there's one thing that's lacking in the goddamn culture right now in the world is context. It's just an onslaught of fucking mostly garbage being dumped into our heads on a daily fucking basis that either we attach to our feelings or we just get overwhelmed and panicky. But getting personal context for who the fuck you are and really, owning that. So if the shit really goes down, at least you'll have that. At least you'll know who you are. Anyways, a little bit dramatic, but I appreciated the ideas in that email. And then there was this one, because, anti-Semitism, it's part fanatic religiosity, anti-Semitism, complete utter racism, flat out authoritarian tactics of corralling and torturing and exiling and who knows what's next, minority people, marginalizing of people already marginalized is a real thing. So when I talk about being a Jew or I talk about anti-Semitism, and even one email comes to me, I'm going to react. But this was sort of, this is why it's important, outside of, the general reasons. I get an email, Jamie Denbo and the Overwhelming Judaism. Hey, Mark, I've been listening to WTF since I saw the second season of Marin on Netflix, however many beers ago that was. I just listened to the Jamie Dembo interview, and I'd like to address that other listener who was in denial about being anti-Semitic. Fuck that guy. Keep on talking about all the Jewy stuff. I'm a rare Vermont Jew currently living in a no-Jew town in North Idaho. Some days it feels like your angst, self-loathing, and chats with other Jews are the only ways I can relate to society. The idea of performing activities in life without worrying about how it's going to affect my entry to heaven is completely foreign to all my neighbors. Your podcast reminds me of all the worst parts of growing up Jewish and sometimes even makes me reminisce about the good parts, although I'm pretty sure that being Jewish means that you're supposed to love hating all of it. That was him in parentheses. Your talk with Jamie reminded me of all the great friendships I made and promptly abandoned in Jewish camps and Hebrew school, reminded me of all the horrible videos that I was subjected to about the Holocaust, and that there isn't a time in life where I haven't been worried about every last thing that could maim or kill me, both in thanks to my mother's extreme worries about me and my siblings. You also remind me that we are the people who have had to figure it out on our own, away from the rest of society, and this mentality is something I carry with me daily. If we could wander through the desert for 40 years, survive the Holocaust, survive the diaspora, and survive every other challenge the rest of the world throws at our people, I can muster the strength to open the sticky jar of jelly in my refrigerator to spread our leftover matzah after Pesach. Anyways, I know that you're going to do your thing regardless of what I say, but don't stop talking about Jewish life. Anyone who doesn't want to hear it probably already knows where the fast forward button is on their device. Wish you good mental health. Best of luck to the cats, Brendan. Thanks, man. I do that. I think I do what you're saying instinctively, but there was a couple, and then I got this other one, but, and this is another thing that we don't realize about the Jamie Dembo interview, growing pains subject line. Hey, Mark, just a little note on growing up with the awareness for Second World War atrocities. German here, growing up in the 80s in Germany, we were confronted with the facts quite early as well. I think around 8 or 9 years old, we read the first book about it in school. And from there, it's basically a nonstop guilt trip until graduating high school. And for the better, don't get me wrong, never forget so it doesn't happen again, is burned into me. And I think that's a good thing. I immediately related to Jamie mentioning how early you guys had to deal. And it reminded me of my own very specific German guilt education. Anyway, love your work. Keep your head up. Kind regards and hello from Amsterdam, Lucy. See, I didn't know that. Like, I didn't know, like, I mean, obviously I knew that, you know, Germans had to reckon with it, but I didn't know it was like, you know, kind of a promoted and persistent kind of driving awareness into the brain of new generations. And the reason this stuff is important because is that, you know, progressive sense or that human sense of right and wrong in relation to history is starting to buckle. And this one, I think, is nice because it's Canadian and it's kind of funny. And then we'll, you know, get to Stephen here in a minute. The subject line on this is just Montreal Jews. Hey, Mark, in the Jamie Dembo episode, which is great, of course, I was stunned. That was him in parentheses. I was stunned to hear you refer to Howie Mandel as a Montreal Jew. He's a Toronto Jew. Leonard Cohen. Now that's a Montreal Jew. Love the show. Keep up the great work. Best, Trevor. Okay, I will not make that mistake again, Trevor. Leonard Cohen, Montreal Jew. Howie Mandel, Toronto Jew. Stephen Colbert. I talked to Stephen, as I said, in his in the tucked away place in the Ed Sullivan Theater that used to be a small theater that Letterman used to use to screen things. And we had a very, you know, engaged and, you know, kind of intense and fast talk. You know, Stephen will go, man. Stephen will go. So I want you to listen to this. Enjoy it. Obviously, The Late Show with Stephen Colbert airs weeknights on CBS and on CBS All Access. And this is me talking to Stephen Colbert.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Fair.
This was Dave's screening room.
Yeah, they, yeah.
You got the whole history of it?
Not quite. What do you think went on in here? Is this...
This was screening. There used to be a $100,000 projector behind that. And this was... These risers had, there were, comfy seats like this here and there.
Yeah.
And that's a screen right over there. And so it would be actually projected, I think both film and digital.
So that was a nice thing. It wasn't a...
Oh, really? No, it was a really nice thing. It was a great way to watch a movie.
Do you know, as you've been here as long as you have, have you become obsessed with the history of the place? Or is it just for you?
Certainly before the show started, Mark,
yeah.
Because now that once you're there,
yeah.
As much as it's great to be in the Ed Sullivan Theater,
yeah.
At a certain point, it's just a place you're working.
I know,
and
right?
Because you don't see it from the outside.
No.
I don't see the marquee. I never come in that side of the building.
Right.
I don't get any sense of the space at all.
Isn't that sad?
Well, I suppose so. The one thing that reminds me, thank you. The one thing that reminds me is that damn dome in that theater. It's so beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
Like the actual space itself is so lovely.
Yeah.
But of course, then when you end up doing the show, when you actually walk out on stage to do the show,
yeah.
It's you want to stay aware of the audience and the
right.
vibe and everything, but it's you and the camera.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I've never gotten the hang of that.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, when I go out on stage, it's very hard for me to acknowledge that I'm just really performing for the camera. Like if I'm performing stand up and there's a camera, generally I'm looking at the audience. Every time I've done panel on your show or on Conan's show, I will always go to the audience. Like I'll look at them and I'll do one of these and then I'm not even looking at the camera and I'm playing for the audience.
Well, yeah.
It's a trick. You had to learn it.
Well, it's a fine line. It's a fine line. You gotta, you're getting all your vibe from the audience, you know? And so you always have to be aware of them because you guys are in this sort of little partnership for this next hour. But yeah, it's all going down the pipe.
Yeah. So
you gotta see where the.
What do you have yet?
Are we doing, is this the show, by the way?
Probably. So
I like it. That's really the thin end of the wedge. Really, literally, as I'm sitting in the, roll. No, he'll never even know. I'll get him to say shit he'll regret for years.
How did you even, I'm doing it on your equipment.
Oh,
of course we're rolling. The guys left. They left.
I guess we are rolling. That's good.
Yeah. I was wondering when I was walking over here waiting outside with my bag. Usually I have my recorder in my bag, but they offered to set this up for me.
Sure.
Do you ever get to that point, and I didn't feel this way about you, where you're like, oh, Christ, how much longer do we work?
Oh, work with each other?
No, just in general. Just kind of like, here we go.
Oh, I was just having this conversation with Mindy Kaling, actually. And
really?
I interviewed her on Saturday for the Montclair Film Festival. And she asked me, how much longer are you going to do this?
Yeah.
And I'll tell you the story I told her, which is that
I love the stories that you've repeated.
I never finished it with her.
Oh, good.
Is that when I was thinking about ending the Colbert Report, which was about 7 years in.
Yeah.
Well, I did it for 9.5 years, but 7 years in. I've gotten to know Dick Cavett over the years. Have you ever talked to Dick at all?
I haven't interviewed him, but I've talked to him before. Yeah.
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 Great. All the best stories you want to hear.
Sure. And his brain is like a bingo cage. You just you mention a name and he'll pull out a number.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You're spinning an old Rolodex and just boom.
Throw a name
out. Drop your finger anywhere he wants.
Yeah.
And he'll tell you about Brando told him why to always order a tequila sunrise.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah.
And it's actually Campari and orange juice is the Brando drink.
Is that the thing?
Yeah.
My mom used to drink Campari and soda. It was a hip drink for a while
in
the 70s, Campari.
So I asked him, we have drinks every so often, and we're
is it a club for?
At the Yale Club.
Okay.
Yeah, because he's a Yaley.
You're a Yaley?
No, he's a Yaley. My dad taught there, my brother went there.
Right.
And my daughter went there, and I'm jealous of all of them because I always
But they let you in? You're grandfathered in?
Only if I'm in with someone else.
Really?
I don't know. I don't know how it works.
Your kid can't put you on the list?
I don't think so. I have never been in without a Yaley, so I don't know if they take a cheek scraping and see whether it comes up ivy.
Right.
But I said, hey, how long did you do your show?
Yeah.
The first time. And he said, oh, okay. And he knew immediately what I was asking. I didn't know.
When can I stop?
Exactly. And he said, because he did his show so many times. He did so many different iterations on different networks.
Right.
And he said to me he goes, how long do you think Jack Parr was on the air? And I'll ask you, how long do you think Jack Parr was on the air?
12 years.
4 years.
But he's mythologized.
Yes, Jack Parr was on for 4 years.
That's it.
Well, he came back
on the Tonight Show.
He came back with the Jack Parr show later because, and Cavett wrote for Jack. I call him Jack.
Yeah.
And he said that Parr regretted it. He regretted having left after 4 years, that there was
more
chicken on that. I don't know if it was the grind or the demands of the network or whatever, but after 4 years he left and then he regretted it and came back with Jack Parr Show, which was a good show, but just was never the same.
I don't think people knew then that you could stay on the air for 40 years. I mean, television was pretty, still kind of newish.
No, I mean, if you watch the American Masters on Johnny Carson, evidently the story that they tell in American Masters that Johnny said, I can't take over for Jack Parr. Who can take over for Jack Parr?
Yeah.
I mean, he's been there for 4 years.
4 years.
Exactly. Yeah. There's no way to take over for Jack Parr. He's a giant. No one will ever. And his wife, one of the Joan or Joanne, said, don't give the job to somebody else. Let me talk to him. She put on a dress and went to the head of the network and said, I'll make him take the job.
And he took it.
So how much longer? I don't know. I enjoy it.
Yeah?
I enjoy it. And that's how long you're supposed to do it, right?
Well, I guess my...
Technically, you're supposed to do it until you don't enjoy it anymore. Only a few more years after you don't enjoy it, right?
I guess, but I don't I'm not a guy that really understands when he's enjoying something. So
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I like having the gig and I like being engaged and doing a thing. I like talking to people and I like getting on stage. But when I really think about it, am I I can't wait to get out there? I don't know. I really don't know how often that happens.
I kind of want to get out there. I mean, okay. I kind of want to get out there.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we worked on these jokes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I want to see if these work.
Yeah.
Let's go. I mean, we spent the day working on this thing.
Exactly. And for me.
And that guy's coming. So it'd be nice to talk to that guy.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I want to warm up the audience for my guest.
Do you?
No.
No.
I want the audience warmed up for me. Then the guest's going to have what's left. No, but for me, actually, and I want to go out there to be in front of the audience.
Yeah.
And to be really to be with them.
Yeah.
Because I don't, because I, we're constantly being told that we're crazy for thinking something's crazy these days.
Right.
Like there's a group of Americans who think this is crazy and wonder whether they're crazy for thinking it's crazy. And I think that's who my audience is that they like the community of knowing that I'm coming out there and saying, you're not crazy. This is crazy.
Well, that's become,
and I want that. I want that as the host.
But that's like, but that became the mission, you know, after a certain point.
Well, I immediately was the mission.
Right.
It took me a while to express it and to know it to myself that that's what it was. But it was immediately the visceral emotional feeling I had to be with the audience the closer and closer we got to the election.
Yeah. But at the beginning, like, I guess my question to start with is that, like, I mean, I don't know, when you first got the gig, and I don't remember when I exactly did your show, and we have a bit of history that we should talk about, but I don't know that, yeah, a little bit.
We have history?
Brief. We actually talked about it on your show a little bit.
Oh, yeah. No, we've
worked in the same building next to each other in the office.
Sure.
But it's a weird job. It's a very specific job that you ended up with.
Yes.
And it was something I think you were prepared for on a certain level.
Maybe.
But you know, I don't know that you ever saw yourself doing that.
Never.
That you
this
were
was not an ambition of mine.
What was the ambition?
Regardless of what anybody thinks, yeah, that like I was laying in wait for one of the network guys to
I don't
leave.
Think I never felt I like never, you were that.
People wrote stuff like that, but like, you know, Stephen Colbert cleverly arranged his Comedy Central contract so it would be up when Dave's was up. There was stuff like
the
that
speculators.
Was written.
Speculators.
Yeah, yeah.
When you look at the news every day, it's very important that you realize just how much it's speculation by people that kind of know things. There's, like, the actual news is the news. And then there's thousands of people going like, what if? Maybe this happened. I think this happened.
One of my producers, Barry Julian, yeah, calls it the uninformed influencing each other in real time. That's what most news is.
but I guess but what did you see? What was the goal? Because it might
The goals. I mean, I really should have more goals, probably.
But I mean,
I didn't have a. I didn't really have necessarily a goal. The biggest sort of change for me. There have been only a couple of big career changes for me. Was my original goal was to be Hamlet.
Yeah.
You know, not even like act Real Hamlet, to be Hamlet.
To actually be Hamlet.
Well, I mean, I don't know. As a young actor, sure, I did not have the experience to know that you could differentiate yourself between like your narrative heroes and yourself.
You wanted to just become them.
I just wanted to like be actively sad at people because I was a sad, sad young man. And then I met people in comedy.
Yeah.
And I started doing it. And I went, oh, you know when it's working because the audience makes that noise. That's always fun.
Yeah.
And comedy sort of saved my life as a young man, like the comedians that I admired. And sort of they got me through childhood tragedy and such. And then I realized I just loved improvisation. And so I remember actively going, okay, I'm not going to do straight theater.
Right.
Because whenever I get paid to do comedy. Like straight theater, I tend to be doing it for free.
So this was an evolution. So the improv thing. But if we go back then, I know you're Catholic. I know you have a huge family.
Yes.
So when you go back, when you talk about, like, where'd you grow up?
Well, I was born in Washington, D.C., but I left there when I was four. And I spent the rest of my childhood in South Carolina, first on James Island, South Carolina, and then in Charleston, South Carolina.
With a tremendous amount of children. There was a lot of kids.
11 kids. Jimmy, Eddie, Mary, Billy, Margaret, Tama, Jay, Lulu, Paul, Peter, and Steven.
So you know all of them?
I know most of them pretty well.
And
big family. It's a big family.
Well, yeah, but to me, that's crazy. I can't even imagine it. And
do you have brothers and sisters?
I have one.
Which
and
one?
It's enough. I have a brother. I have a younger brother.
Okay. So you're the responsible one.
I get kinda. I mean, not really. I mean, okay. It went back and forth, but it turns out I ended up there somehow. Okay. But growing up, when you say there's some questions I want to ask about, faith and about family.
Sure.
But when you say that it saved, that comedy saved you from tragedy, it was because you lost family, right?
Right. My father and two of my brothers died in a plane crash, Eastern Airlines Flight 212 on September 11th, 1974. And so it didn't save me from tragedy, but it gave
the
me...
The sadness.
It gave me surcease from sadness, you know, at the end of the day. And I would listen to Bill Cosby, Wonderfulness.
Yeah.
And Bill Cosby, Very Funny Fellow, Right.
Yeah.
Which is, that's the Noah one. And then Wonderfulness has got go-karts on it.
Back when we could listen to Bill Cosby.
Right.
Yeah.
And that, and then after that.
On records.
Who
had the records? Did your parents have the records?
No, one of my brothers.
How old's your oldest brother?
Oh, he's 19 years older than I am, so he's in his 70s now.
So when something like that happens in a family of that size, I imagine that there's a lot of built-in support automatically.
Well, yes, we love each other very much, but we're kind of scattered, you know.
No, but I mean like when that happened. When the tragedy happened, you were all kind of around, weren't you?
We were all together.
Yeah.
You know, we were all together. I mean, it was a strange transition time in our family. And this is a slightly longer... there's no short answer to your question.
That's okay.
Because, you know...
You don't have a show to do, do you?
No, I don't. I know. September 10th.
Yeah.
You know, you might say, like I say, September 10th, 1974.
Yeah.
It was me and Mom and Dad and Peter and Paul and Jay and Lulu and Tommy and Bill.
Yeah.
So like nine people in the house.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
And then, but Lulu, Jay, and Tommy go off to college.
Yeah.
Because in September, Bill goes off, I think Bill go off to law school, or he moved out for sure. Peter, Paul, and... Dad die, and suddenly it's just me and Mom in the house. It's like people were around, and people like came back because of how this terrible tragedy affected our entire family. But really, for the next X number of years, it went from this enormous, busy, joyously kind of chaotic, it's okay if things aren't perfect kind of family,
right?
To me and Mom, and it became very quiet, and the shades were all down, and you know there. Mom was always wearing black, and it was a totally different daily communicants, you know, like going to mass every day, you know, looking for faith to get you through this bewildering level of tragedy and loss.
Grief,
disorienting in many ways, and feels unreal and hyper-real at the same time. And so was there a lot of support? Yes, we were all there for each other,
right.
But I being the youngest and the middle two, the ones between me and the next ones up dying.
Yeah.
And the other ones were old enough that they had their lives. They had college or they were married and children. So it was a that fall was a dramatic change in what my life was like. And of course, our entire family's life was like. But in terms of me, of how many family were around, it became just me and Mom.
And when you look back on it in terms of, I don't know how much introspection you do outside of, you know... the faith.
I try not to look in the mirror.
Yeah.
You know, I try to shave against just a corkboard.
See what happens. Let someone tell me if I missed something.
Right. Sure.
No, but do you see that, like how, like that moment is in terms of how it defined the rest of your life?
Sure.
Yeah.
That was, you know, that was my secret name was September 11th.
Mm-hmm.
That was the secret name I wouldn't tell anybody.
Yeah.
And I even said that, you know, I remember coming to the realization that my secret name was September
11th. What does that mean, secret name?
Well, there's the name that you tell everyone else, and then there's the name by which you can be conjured if you're a demon.
Okay, I get it.
Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
That is my secret name. You know, you tell someone, don't tell me your secret name, or else they have control over you.
And then it became a global, tragedy.
Well, that was very strange after 9/11,
as
opposed to September 11th in my mind.
Yeah.
When 9/11 happened, suddenly that became a totemic day of tragedy for... people all over the world, not even just the United States, but of course, very specifically. And I watched it live from the Helix, you know, 9/11, watching the towers.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing billboards after that that would say, you know, September 11th, never forget.
Yeah.
Which is totally understandable. And I understand that. But I remember thinking personally going, really never?
Yeah.
Because that means something different to me.
It does,
really,
right?
Really never?
Yeah.
Never. I just don't like I really want to forget, but do I have to carry that with me all the time?
Yeah.
Because you know, when you get struck with great tragedy, the absolute natural life-affirming and life-saving inclination is to scab over that.
Sure.
You know, yeah. With whatever, you know.
And time usually does it.
If time
you don't
does it.
Keep
and,
reopening
and,
it.
And so does comedy.
Yeah.
You know, some of us comedy. I fled him down the nights and down the days. I fled him down the labyrinthine ways of my own mind. I hid from him under running laughter, which is the hound of heaven. You know that poem?
By who?
Gerard Manley Hopkins. I'm not sure who it is, but it's the hound of heaven.
It's basically nice.
It's about God pursuing you with the truth and with love. And how you flee because you don't want to know that you are loved. You don't want to know.
Is that true?
I think it's hard to be fully known.
Yeah.
You know, as St. Paul says, then I will be known. Known as fully as, then I will know as fully as I am known, because God knows you fully. And that's a hard thing to surrender to, is to be fully known.
It's terrifying to me.
Because then you have to, if you know that someone else knows you fully, say for those of you who are listening, if there is a God, and I know that for many people that makes no sense, but if there is a God and he fully knows you, that's an interesting, accusation that someone else fully knows you.
Right.
Because the question is, do I fully know me? Shouldn't I? And then that's an invitation to self-examination,
right?
You know,
but that's sort of the core of faith in a way. That if you allow yourself to be fully known by God, then the rest is sort of you know, like I can only do my best.
I suppose so. It's humility. It's an act of humility.
Well, that's a good question in terms of when I, you know, coming back around, and then we can fill in the gaps. Is that I felt that, you know, when you were doing the Colbert Report. And then, you know, you take this job, part of this job that you have now on some level is allowing a weird sliver of yourself to be fully known in a way that is accessible and authentic, maybe not all of you, but, you know, that part has got to resonate.
Sure.
So that must have, I thought, been an amazing challenge.
Oh, a huge one. Like the one that I couldn't possibly prepare for.
Right.
Because I was at an event the other night, and someone said, "Oh, do you act?"
Yeah.
And I said, "Oh, until 4 years ago, that's all I did."
Yeah.
You know, I'm 54 years old, and from age 22, whenever I, you know, got out of theater school, till 50, I was an actor. And the Colbert Report was a 10-year sketch.
Yeah.
It was a 10-year scene. It had a beginning, a middle, and an end. Yeah. And I had a character want. I either achieved it, I didn't. My scene partner was the audience. I never thought of doing it alone.
Right.
I was doing a scene with someone.
Yeah. Right.
Trying to convince them and also have them love me.
Yeah.
What does anybody want? What does any character want in any play or anything? Love me.
Right.
And so that was the whole objective. It was like, please love me. And so it's strange for me now to be myself. I even said to James Baby Doll Dixon, the real king of late night, who represents me and John and Kimmel.
Yeah,
And I said, because he said, it's you.
Yeah.
Because it was like, who's going to be? And they said, they want to talk to you about it.
Yeah.
And I said, James, the last thing I thought I would do next is something harder.
Yeah. Yeah, when's this get easier?
And he goes, no, it's going to be easier. I said, I don't believe you. And I was right, by the way. It's much harder. But the other thing I said was like, James, this will be the first time I haven't been an actor. Like, you don't understand. Like, that's not me on the Colbert Report. That's me acting, using the character as a confession,
right,
in a way,
yeah,
of some of my darkest impulses as a human being. But right. I don't even think even necessarily my dark impulses, just human dark impulses.
Sure.
You know,
right.
I want to be the most important one. I want the only person. Like, I want all the praise.
Just a malignant ego.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And to have that reinforced and have the audience cheer on me embodying their appetites.
Right.
You know, that's why they would like, I'd have a guest on that they agreed with, but they would cheer me when I would knock the person's ideas down.
Right.
Through this embodiment of appetites.
And now you had to be put in a position to figure out who you are, what your timing is.
Yes.
You know, am I funny in that way as me, Stephen?
Right. And what do I care about?
Yeah.
Because you got to talk about things every night and you can't really fake it. You have to kind of care.
When did the battle stop being sadness?
What do you mean?
In yourself. I mean, like, you know, when you come out of what you came out of and you're using, you know, listening to comedy, you're using faith to sort of like,
I mean, what do you mean? When did it stop being sadness?
Okay.
Yeah, the battle's always sadness.
Yeah.
The whole battle's always sadness, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it frightens me, the awful truth of how sweet life can be.
Me too.
Yeah.
It's
and the preciousness and the fleetingness of life. Having lost those people in my life when I was young, makes everything seem fleeting to me. You know,
so that stays with
you. Oh, absolutely. There's a poem by a guy. He's got an Italian name, but I think he's Swiss. Mm-hmm. And his name was Romano Guardini. And Romano Guardini is a Catholic writer,
yeah,
a philosopher, and maybe a clergyman. I can't remember. And he's got this great prayer about the fullness of eternity and about how in the dawn we perceive the dusk.
Yeah.
We know it's coming.
Yeah.
So I constantly do the math,
right,
of like, how long will this beautiful moment last? So
right.
There's always that. It's suffused through,
yeah,
all of my joy.
Yeah.
Is how long will this last?
But you're capable of experiencing joy.
Without a doubt. Oh, that's constantly.
Great. Oh, that's so
all
good.
The time, but it's not alone. It's not like unalloyed.
Yeah.
It's not unalloyed. It's I've definitely got some tin in my iron, but it makes steel.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
That's nice. No, but I joy all the time. Joy with my family, joy with my friends that I do the show with.
Yeah.
For the beauty of the earth, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, but for the little green leaf and the wind on the water, like the joy of creation, how strange it is to be anything at all. I get that feeling all the time.
That's great. So when you were younger then, and this thing happens and you start going to church, is that when—
Start? No, I was already, like, our family was already very devout.
Right, but was—
But it ramped up, definitely.
Right, because it was, is that when it kind of infused in you the deeper understanding?
No.
Because it seems like you're fairly—
The deeper understanding didn't come till I was— older, you know, I had what for me passed for fairly profound revelations when I was older, I was in my 20s.
Oh yeah,
because I became an atheist for many years. I left quite sadly about it. I didn't want to not have a God.
Yeah.
If for no other reason that I really wanted to see my father and my brothers again, you know, which is the most understandable. But in some ways, kind of most selfish reason to have a God.
Yeah.
You know, but that was real. That was a promise that was given to me that I will see them again.
Right.
And the fact that I was sure that there was no God for many years, four is many.
Yeah.
Sent me into a terrible spiral of depression. I lost 50 pounds.
You lost 50 pounds?
I lost 50 pounds like in 6 months.
Did you need to lose 50 pounds?
No, it was exactly, I weigh exactly, when I went to college, I weigh exactly what I weigh right now.
And you lost 50 in college?
50 pounds less than I do now, my freshman year, almost by Christmas. I mean, I lost so, because I wouldn't eat. I was
so
sad.
Went into a tailspin.
Went a complete tailspin, exactly.
Because God left.
And unaddressed grief that when he left, there was an unaddressed
And then
grief.
Also you're like in a new place, new people.
Sure.
Like you're away for the—
Sure.
Yeah.
I think my mother did a fantastic job of being not bitter and being helping me try to see a beauty in the world after the dad and the boys died. But without a doubt, there was a subterranean hum all the time of me wanting to be okay for her.
Yeah.
And I didn't have to do that.
Yeah.
And I found out I completely was not okay.
Right.
You know, 8 years later, I was completely not okay.
So so how did it start, the acting thing? How did it start, you know, kind of manifesting you? Like,
I don't know. I mean, part of it was sort of inspired by my mom. She'd wanted to be an actress.
Yeah.
And she had actually studied at the New School for Social Research,
sure,
as they called it, the New School here,
yeah,
in the late 30s,
yeah,
and early 40s. And she... was going to Carnegie
Mellon,
to the Carnegie Institute,
yeah,
to study theater, and got terribly sick. Actually, got like literally went on a tour with her mother of the Caribbean on a yacht or something like,
yeah,
that, or a cruise ship, and got a rare tropical disease, like a caricature of a rare tropical disease in Haiti, and nearly died.
Huh.
Like absolutely was at death's door for months and months and months and months, and couldn't go off to school as a result. And in her recovery period, my father said, "Will you marry me?" And wow. So they got married and had 11 children rather than going off to be an actress as she'd wanted to be. And so on a certain level, though not consciously, I mean, we never discussed it and I never said it to myself, I was doing it inspired by, and I have to imagine in some ways for her.
Yeah.
Though I wanted it myself. And before any of that, I really wanted to be a comedian.
Really?
But I didn't know what that meant.
Yeah.
But like literally, like Cosby.
Yeah.
Carlin,
yeah.
Steve Martin.
Sure.
They were everything. And David Fry. Those were my everything, those guys. And
we're the same age. What are you?
I'm 54.
I'm 55. So yeah,
I'll be
so
55 soon, yeah.
So that's the records you had.
Those are the records, exactly. Yeah.
When
yeah.
you're like in seventh grade.
Right.
Yeah.
And who's the guy who did Nixon? I mean, who did Kennedy? Van Heflin.
No, he just died not too long ago.
Yeah, he did, yeah. His career.
Von Meter, yeah.
Yeah, we had the Von Meter albums too.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, I just wore those out. And I kind of secretly wanted to do that. I remember I confessed to a neighbor of mine, a girl named Tinker Hallam, who lived around the corner
from
me.
Good name.
Great name. Yeah. Very nice person. And Tinker, she was like, well, what do you want to be? And I said, well, I want to be a comedian. She goes, oh, you'd be very funny as a comedian. I didn't know, what do you do?
How old were you, like 10?
No, 11? that's teens, mid-teens. Oh, yeah? That's like, I'm like 15, I didn't know what that meant. How do you become a comedian?
Sure.
What does that mean?
I said the same thing, and then one day you find out, like years later. There's no way to know.
Right.
Yeah, at that age. Well, what were you doing to occupy your time as a high school kid?
Playing a lot of Dungeons and Dragons.
So you were really, you know, dug into the fantasy trip.
Yeah, sure. Start off with science fiction first.
But
though.
Not a rock and roll guy. You weren't out partying. You were.
No, I did that like shortly thereafter. I mean, there was a period of time in my late teens, my junior year, one of my friends introduced me to a friend of his. I was kind of a social outcast in my school.
Because of your nerdness?
Yeah, kind of my nerdness. I was withdrawn.
Withdrawn and sad?
Yeah, I was drawn and sad and dark and nothing made any sense to me.
But you didn't, did you accessorize that or were you just sort of...
No, I...
You weren't proudly...
You did not accessorize that at Porter Gowd School.
There's no... You had to wear an outfit?
There was a loose... I mean, yeah, it was like basically... It wasn't official, but you had to wear a blazer and a tie.
Oh, so you couldn't be proudly sad and... Dark. And,
I was not wearing a t-shirt held together by safety pins or anything like that. that was
no accessorizing the sadness.
No. So it was like, you know, regimental striped ties and blue blazers and Oxford button-down shirts and khaki pants. And
oh, that makes me nervous.
And dark sides. What?
That the screen just went away where they're recording.
Is that I think it just went to sleep.
It's just a screensaver?
Yeah, I think it's just a screensaver. We'll find out.
Ugh.
Okay.
Should I get the guys in here to check it?
No, it's fine.
Hey, everything all right over there?
Oh, screensaver.
What did I say?
I know you were right,
Steve. Why are you panicking?
Because, like, you know, it's one of those things where you know, I've lost a couple. I lost two Hodgmans.
Two Hodgmans?
Yeah.
Wow. Two in a row?
Are we still good? Yeah.
Two different Hodgmans?
Two different Hodgmans for different reasons. And I've done 1,000 or more of these things, but there was a couple of times...
Can you imagine if you'd lost your Obama?
Oh, no, we were backed up 3 times for that.
Sure.
3 times. Sure. They were recording it.
Yeah, there's no backup for this.
No, this is it, buddy.
This is on a wire recorder.
So you're D&D, outcast.
Yeah, sure.
Weird kid. There's exactly. Steven. Well, how do we handle him?
Yeah, then I am smoking a lot of weed.
Yeah?
I end up smoking a lot of weed, yeah.
Reading sci-fi?
No, then I moved into a different crowd. Because then I was with the group that... was called the Foggy Five. Then we were, you know, getting foggy together.
Oh, that was a secret club.
That was
the
Foggy Five.
So people knew you as that, but still still kind of outcasty.
Well, different kind because it, you know, we self-imposed kind of outcasty at that point. Like that. Now we found this really nice little, you know, clutch of friends.
Yeah.
Who all of us were damaged in our own ways. Sure. Like either broken homes or also dead brothers and sisters and fathers and. It was a nice little group of damaged people, which I just love the damaged, which is everybody.
Yeah.
But, and so that
you were heading for comedy early. You were on your way.
Yeah. And then actually what we would do is I got known for telling stories is that we would get all baked and then I would take someone into like a closet, close the door and I would tell them a story.
Yeah.
Like a fantasy adventure they would go on. Yeah. Like they fly through space and go under the water and ride dolphins and stuff like that. And Peter and people would say, "Oh, go, me next, me next." And I would tell them a new story.
So that was the thing, Steve.
Yeah,
does
I would get
thing?
Like a, like a, like three. It would be like me and Chip and Russell and Tom, and I would cram them onto a small closet. And I go, "You're floating in space." As you put your arms around yourself to hug yourself, it torques you into a spin. And the stars wheel around you into a blur until one of them settles into view and grows larger, and you're plunging toward the sun. And like I would do these sort of, you know, audio adventures for them.
Yeah.
And that was my first sort of like, oh, I bet I could tell people stories. I bet that would be fun. So I started doing a lot of that.
Uh-huh.
And then I started experimenting with lying a lot.
Yeah.
But not
in
lying.
In real life.
But lying, like if somebody didn't know me, I would always lie what my bio was. I liked making up who I was a lot.
Yeah.
Constantly.
Yeah.
And even for years, even when I became a professional, I lied in all my bios.
Yeah.
None of them were really.
Was there a relief to it? Is that what it was?
I don't know.
Or just fun?
It was just fun. I just loved the fantasy.
But it wasn't because
it.
Like I'm not good enough or you just kind of liked fucking with people.
Well, yeah, I just like taking them on a little mental adventure, because I loved it so much. I got so much out of it by reading science fiction or fantasy that I would create these little scenarios for other people because, you know, go with what you know. And I spent all my time either playing Dungeons and Dragons, reading science fiction, or reading fantasy. I mean, all my time. If I had put half of the time into my schoolwork, I would have gone to Yale. But of course, I didn't. I played Dungeons and Dragons and read Larry Niven and Isaac Asimov and L. Sprague de Camp and Robert Heinlein and Henry Kuttner and Sam Kornbluth and all deep cut Jack Vance and people like that.
What did you, in looking back on it, what did you get out of all that? Was it just enjoyment
a pretty
or
good
just
broad
possible?
Education?
I would think so.
A pretty good broad education because I read I'm on pace, you know, a book a day, and because science fiction writers tend to be certainly somebody like Asimov, polymaths, and generalists, and sort of professionally curious. You'd learn a lot of things incidentally. The things I could not bullshit my way through from all this general knowledge I was getting from reading tons of science fiction. You can't bullshit math.
Yeah.
And
I know
you
that
can't
one. Yeah.
Bullshit French.
Yeah.
You know, which is like math, like the declinations and all that. It's like doing
math.
Well,
I've just started doing a joke on stage recently because I used to say you can't charm your way through math.
100%.
Everything else.
100%. I was charming my way.
Yeah.
I wrote pretty good essays and stuff like that so I could get history class, history class or English class or something.
And they like
that.
They like your moxie. They like your spunk and they like your.
A little bit. I had an opinion in history class. Yeah. You know, I did not shut up. I actually engaged in those classes.
Well, I do this line on stage now where I say, you know, if your job doesn't involve math, you're bullshitting on some level.
That's nice. Well, yeah. I mean, that's why the best sports are the ones that don't have judges.
Oh, yeah.
The ones are like, did you run faster than the other person?
Right.
You win. Did you jump higher? You win.
Right.
That's math.
Yeah.
Everything else is bullshit. Yeah. Beautiful. And I'm not saying it shouldn't be in the Olympics, but there should be this asterisk next to every, like, yeah, you won. I mean, it's bullshit, but you won.
Good for you.
Are you happy about that?
They have that. It's wrestling. It's like there's a lot of different things.
Yeah. Real wrestling, that's objective. Did you pin the person?
No, I know that. No, I'm talking about
did you wrestle?
The spectacle.
Did you wrestle?
I did not do any sports.
No sports?
No.
Not even hacky sack?
No, no. I mean, I learned how to juggle at some point. I used to play some tennis.
Put that on your Tinder profile. Sports, I juggle.
No, I swam as a kid for a while, and I tried to play Little League, and then... I did.
You couldn't play Little League?
I just was on like the Bad News Bears teams. We were just a shitty team.
Right.
I mean, I could catch
me
a ball.
Me too.
You know, and I swam and you know, I'm athletic, but I never played competitive sports.
How do you know you're athletic?
Because I run and I lift and I do things. I can hit a softball. I can catch. I play
a
little tennis.
You can hit a softball is your definition of athletic? Uh-huh.
I can lift things. What are you talking? What are you putting me on? I don't
Athleticism, I think, also involves a certain amount of... grace, awareness.
Yes,
of,
I have all that. I just,
but I'm you not, haven't, you've never tested it.
Sure, I have. I run a few miles. I hike up a hill.
Not, and that
I can
you
hit
can
a ball.
Run a few miles, so you can like
I can
out
swim.
That's evolutionary. If you
swim,
couldn't do that, your ancestors would not have lived long enough for you to exist.
Well, what would I need to do, Stephen? I mean, well, I can't throw a ball through a hoop. I can't do that. Am I out?
That would be athletic. Yes, that would be athletic.
I can, but
hand eye coordination.
I can play tennis. I can hit a ball.
Okay.
All right, so am I good?
Are you good at tennis?
I'm all right.
Then you're not athletic. You what have to be good at something. You have to be good at a sport to be called athletic. You are playing a sport. That's not the same thing as being athletic.
I don't know why this became an attack of my, like, and you're supposed to be one of the good guys. And now I'm like, now I'm a shitty person because I'm not athletic.
Mm-hmm. I've always been acting all those years that you thought I was.
I don't have, I'm not good with competition is the problem. I don't have the temperament for it. I once had a
paper basket shoot off. Yeah. Like, you know, you just take balls up, you know, ball up some paper and you shoot some baskets with Dr. J. He was a guest on the old show.
Yeah.
And right before I went on stage, one of my executive producers said to me, "Hey man, just prepare yourself because, you know, you don't get to be like Dr. J unless you're really competitive."
Yeah.
And I said, "Hey, he should prepare himself because you don't get to host one of these unless you're really competitive."
Yeah, I'm just like, I'm the kind of guy that, like, you know, if in an office situation, you know, when you're playing a dumb game like that, just throwing things in a garbage can, you know, there's the one guy that when he doesn't make it goes, "God, fuck." Like, there's a lot more things going on.
Yes.
About failing.
Is that you?
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay.
It used to be. I don't care anymore. I'm more prone to like throw it in. If it misses, I'll be like, "Of course."
Oh my God, that's so sad. Of course, I deserve to get a piece of paper in a trash can.
Can I just get one? Can it work out once? So close. Look, so you're fantasizing in closets for friends.
Yes,
and you're
and taking, I'm fantasizing in closets for myself too. Yeah. I used to play a lot of magical thinking. I discussed this with Conan on his podcast. So we might be double dipping on podcast, but
magical thinking
is that I would get into like closet and I would go, "Okay, I wonder if I held my breath for a certain amount of time, I could have my brother back."
Oh, wow.
Stuff like that.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, magical thinking is sort of necessary for the suspending of disbelief in order to have faith in the first place, isn't it? I mean, magical thinking in a managed way is
part of
the whole trip, isn't it?
I don't perceive magical thinking and religion as the same thing, because magical thinking, magic is trying to, and I forgot who said this, I'm quoting somebody here.
Yeah.
Magic is an attempt to control the Godhead.
Uh-huh.
Magic is a way to control God.
Right, it's about
will. Creation.
Yeah.
Faith is the opposite.
Got it.
Faith is acceptance.
Yeah.
So it's magical thinking is actually, it's completely antithetical to my faith.
Okay. When do you start actually training as an actor? Tell me about Chicago and that scene. How did you meet? Because, like, how did you get there?
I didn't do any play till I was a senior.
In high school?
In high school, yeah. I finally got up the gumption to audition for something. And I got a part at a local community theater.
Yeah.
And then did the musical with my girlfriend. We were Annie Oakley and Frank Butler and Annie Get Your Gun. And then like, well, but I can't do this. I mean, I can't tell anybody that this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
And so then I also barely graduated from high school.
Really?
My friends, my Dungeons and Dragons friends who were all—
They dragged you down?
No, they were all straight A students. They all opted out. I mean, they all placed out of their exams.
Uh-huh.
Because they're great. They all had A's. So they didn't have to take final exams. They actually sat me down. Like, they did it, like, each one of them took a different day.
Yeah.
They came over to my house, sat me down, and they ran me through, okay, everything you need to know about trig. Here's everything you need to know about French. Here's everything you need to know. And they drilled me for hours.
So you just retained it enough for the test.
Vomited out the next day. I aced every one of my finals, and I graduated from high school. But if I hadn't aced all of them, I would not have graduated with my class.
Yeah.
And so I barely graduated, and then I went to a good college named Hampton Sydney, a college in Virginia that was— You know, I always say it was not that hard to get into, but really hard to stay. You know, they failed a lot of people out.
Yeah.
But they were very rigorous once you got there.
Yeah.
And I learned in some ways how to write there. They had a fantastic rhetoric program. And I did plays there too. And I realized there, when I was there doing those plays, that I thought, oh, wow, wisdom is lost on those who won't act wisely.
Yeah.
And I'm being given a hint here by the universe, because the only thing that I will show up early for and stay late for, and nobody has to ask me to do it, is to work on a play. Like, no one has to say, you should go audition for that. Or and I would, even if I wasn't in it, I would run lines with anybody else.
Yeah.
I would go sweep the theater just to be in the theater.
Well, it's
on
like
campus.
Living within the fantasy land. It's like, that's where
I suppose
it all,
so.
Like, just to be
all
in
the
a
possibilities
theater.
Of that.
Like,
place.
Even here, like, you know, like you notice, even though you take it for granted,
yeah.
You walk into that theater, it is a zone in itself that is fantastic.
Sacred space.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. So you must have felt that early on.
I guess, not sort of consciously. I just really loved being there. All I knew was that it occurred to me one day that I was the first person there, the last person to leave, and I would do any amount of work, and I would run lines 20 times. Even if I had them, I would do it any number of times, and I never complained, and I always was happy to be there. And I went, I should try to do this.
Yeah.
I should sort of confess to myself that this is what I want to do. And this was in the depths of this terrible sadness,
yeah.
Sort of debilitating, almost as like a sickness that I was.
Did you have to go get medicine? Did you have to see a doctor?
They thought I had tuberculosis because I'd lost so much weight. And I was so, like, I got tested for TB because they.
Yeah.
I was green. Like, I was, you looked at me and said, that person's not well.
Oh, man.
Kind of thin. And so then I said, well, I guess I'll try to go to a theater school. I still wanted an undergrad experience. And I'd done well in school. My grades had improved. And so there was nothing to do. Hampton-Sydney College, Hampton-Sydney, Virginia. It's all-male college, 700 students in the middle of the, like 15 minutes from Farmville. That's the town. There's nothing to do there.
Right.
And I wasn't.
And you were sad and skinny.
I was sad. So I spent a lot of time. I did the work
for
2 years.
Right.
And then I transferred to Northwestern University to the theater program there.
So that's
and
Chicago.
then it was completely different. Then that was the beginning of my new life.
Did it turn around? Did your sadness turn around? Do you remember the day? Was there?
No, the sadness did not turn around.
No.
It did. No. As a matter of fact, in some ways it was worse because I was being asked to confront it directly because we were doing sort of method work. And
were you able to?
Not very well. Not very well. I remember my teacher, Ann Woodworth, wonderful teacher who I learned so much from. Didn't even realize how much I learned from until I'd gone to try to work professionally for years.
Yeah.
And then I went, oh, this is what she was teaching me. She saw through a lot of my bullshit.
Yeah.
And my charm. And I was facile. I could learn lines very quickly. I could get a sense of how the scene might work. But there wasn't a lot of an emotional truth to the work that I did. And she kept on saying, but how do you feel? Yeah. And I remember blowing up at her once.
Anger.
Oh, blowing up with her because she wasn't buying my well-constructed facsimile of human emotion for her.
Mm-hmm.
And she's saying, then how do you feel? How do you actually feel? I'm like, I feel fine. Really? How do you feel? And I remember her sitting on the edge of the stage and me, out of nowhere, not knowing how it happened, me like looming over her. Like a wave about to break on her because I'm standing on stage and she's sitting on the edge and she's not looking at me. She's sort of looking off to the side. Me going, I don't like yelling, not even at you, and you want me to yell. And she just said, how do you feel? Like that. And it completely undid me.
Did you cry?
Yeah, absolutely. Just like classic... You know, acting class as therapy, which it should not be,
right.
You know, really gets mistaken for therapy a lot. And that's one of the reasons why I love Barry. That TV show is so brilliant.
It's so good.
It's perfect in every way.
I've watched it. It's so perfect in every way.
And I recognize that acting class so perfectly.
But like, that's that moment though, where, you know, without understanding it, the relationship between sadness and anger is very close.
Sure, because anger is not really your emotion.
Right.
Anger is your last armor before you show your actual emotion.
Like I felt when you just did that exercise in explanation, I felt it. Like I felt that because I'm a guy who lives in a certain amount of anger out of fear of being engulfed by the sadness.
Sure.
Like that, like.
Or to be judged for your feelings.
Well, yeah, I don't know.
For me, it was vulnerability too, to be seen as these feelings were so debilitating.
But it's all you want to do is be seen though. Really?
Yes. You want to be seen, but instead you create some very close version of yourself for people to see.
Yeah, innately. It's not like you're sitting there going, okay,
No. Right. It's just, it snaps together without Legos. Version of you snaps together like Legos without you even thinking about it.
And I'm at this place right now in my life where I'm like, I don't want to manage that shit anymore. What am I so afraid of? You know, like that, like if I open that up, it will never, the crying will never stop.
Yes. if you pay any attention, if you pay any attention to the world, the crying will never stop. That's right.
It's true. Yes. And you know, that it just kind of locks in with the sadness that's already there.
Yeah.
If you already have that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's a daily thing, man.
Yeah.
Right. All right. So
I have, that's a bit of a breakthrough when I realize, I kind of realize in that moment, which is obvious, of course, but I'm not looking at myself. Again, I'm shaving, looking at a corkboard. I'm not really looking at the mirror.
Right. And that was one of those moments.
I guess I am damaged. Right. And my teacher actually said, I won't teach you anymore unless you go to therapy.
Oh, wow. Did you?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
And help?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I took it mildly seriously.
Yeah.
All it did was like open me to the idea that I got a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
And then I didn't do that work.
No, you can hold on to that idea. Like, I just recently re-engaged that idea. Like, sure. Within the last few weeks.
I got a lot of work to do.
I got work to do. I'm going to go do it.
Yep. And then I didn't do it.
Oh.
I didn't do it. But at least, you know, A, she kept me in her class. And also, I became at least aware enough to know that I've got a lot of unresolved stuff going on. And I wonder what that is.
Still?
Not as much. No, not as much. But at that time, yeah.
Did the work do itself?
No. It 100% did not do itself. I had a nervous breakdown when I was 29. Like, literally, like, 10 years after I don't do the work, 10 years later, I had a nervous, like, completely. Like, I wouldn't wish this panic attack on anyone. I wouldn't wish it on anyone. But my worst enemy is I wouldn't want to make feel the way I felt for months.
At 29?
29, yeah, yeah.
So
one month married. How about that? How's that a wedding present for your wife? Is that the guy that she thought she married, she comes home, she's like, what did you do all day? I'm like walking in tight circles around a couch.
Yeah.
You know?
Wow.
She's like, how was your day? And I'm like, you're looking at it, because I was just, if I physically kept moving, like, it wouldn't get me.
Oh.
Do you know what I mean?
From the inside.
Or back here, in the peripheral vision, where you can't see it. It's always there.
Yeah.
The worst possible thing that'll ever happen to you.
Right, right.
Which must never be named.
Yeah.
Ever be known.
Right. You just got to stay steady, busy.
Just keep moving. Keep moving.
That was at 29.
Yeah, yeah.
Where were you in your career?
I was at Second City. I was a working, you know, actor.
Okay, so you go to Northwestern, then you get involved with the...
I do a 3-year program in 2 years, which was kind of intense.
For acting.
Straight up theater major.
Yep.
I mean, you still get like a liberal arts education.
Sure.
It's not a conservatory, but I finished most of that stuff.
And it's undergrad, so you're doing the whole thing.
And I'd finished the core curriculum at Hampton.
The other place, yeah.
And so I came in and essentially just did a conservatory program, the equivalent thereof at Northwestern for 2 years. And I loved it. You know, Shakespeare and Shaw and the ancient Greeks.
It seems like you really take it in. Yeah,
I loved it.
If anything, outside of whatever you didn't study in high school, the compulsion to, you know, really engage with science fiction and fantasy kind of opened your brain, and you seemed to have the grooves laid for any of that stuff.
Yeah, and also Dungeons and Dragons, role playing.
Yeah.
You know?
But like just to really connect, like you connect to poetry. I can feel it. You quote it. It means something.
I love it. I love it. Even when I had no connection to scripture.
Right.
Even when that sort of was hollow for me, then poetry stepped in to be a balm.
Sure.
You know, in Gilead.
Right. Yeah. Because like when poems open up, it's like, oh.
Yeah. That was a great revelation for me, is working on sonnets.
Yeah.
The first thing they had us do in Shakespeare was like, okay, you got to go read a sonnet. You got to read it until you understand it.
Right.
Like, I get it. Like, no, you don't.
And, you keep
and then you read, like, ten times and explicate the meaning and the rhythm. And you go, and suddenly, and it always happens.
Yeah.
It's never not happened.
Right.
It opens like an egg, and you see the chick inside. Right, you go, oh, he's a genius. It's not just, it doesn't just rhyme. It doesn't just mean something. It means one particular thing that's almost behind the cage of those 14 lines of iambic pentameter.
And the way that experience happens, you know, outside of the math. That's one of those things, like, there's a math to it, A, B, A, B.
But it's not the math.
No, it's not. Because then all of a sudden it's like, how could I have ever seen that without, like, you know, you had to do cross the threshold somehow.
Sure.
It's exciting.
When in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone beweep my outcast state and trouble deaf heaven with my bootless cries and look upon myself and curse my fate, wishing me like to one more rich in hope, featured like him with friends possessed, desiring this man's art and that man's scope, and what I most enjoyed contented least. Yet in these thoughts myself almost despising, haply I think on thee. And then my state, like to the lark at break of day, arising from sullen earth, sings hymns at heaven's gate. For thy sweet love remembered such wealth brings, that then I scorn to change my state with kings.
Wow.
That's the first one I worked on.
That's a good one.
It is a good one, isn't
Seems
it?
Seems like a lot of pressure for the woman, whoever he's involved with.
I don't know if it's a woman.
Yeah.
You it could be anyone.
It could be love
in
general.
Anyone.
Right.
Yeah.
Thou.
It's, I just.
Thou.
Thy sweet love remembered.
Yes, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that turmoil of the heart.
Yeah. All when there's nothing in my life, when I'm completely destitute, all I need to do is remember that you exist. Is what that's all I need to do.
And that's a spiritual idea as well.
Sure.
Well, sure. That was yeah. Well, thank you for that beautiful rendition.
Yeah. So, somebody out there is like got out there complete Shakespeare right now. Is going. Oh, did he? Oh no, he inverted two of the lines.
Fucker.
Yeah. Exactly.
You know what? You don't need those people.
I don't need those people in my life. Because yeah, no. I am those people in my life.
Yeah, exactly. They're living within you. And if you're going to get trolled for not doing a sonnet properly.
I'm going to do it.
You're on it.
Don't worry.
Bother. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I've got an
Tell
inner
me something
troll.
I don't know.
My inner troll is all over that. The comment board is full.
He's meaner than you could possibly be.
So right after out of Northwestern, you go into the improv thing?
No, I started improv at Northwestern.
Yeah.
A friend of mine said, hey, do you want to go downtown and see this thing called the Herald Improv at this club in Chicago that doesn't exist anymore called Cross Currents? And it was Del Close and Sharna Halpern and those people were creating this new long form of improvisation called the Herald. It already previously existed, but they turned it into like a competition.
So you knew Del?
Yeah, I studied with Del. Yeah, at the very beginning, not a lot. I never had like a. Some people have sort of a guru relationship with him, and I don't mean that pejoratively. I just mean that I just didn't spend enough time with him for him to become that meaningful of a figure in my life.
But was it before?
But he was the first person to teach me improv.
But was that before he became sort of this?
He was
Buddha.
No, he was already like he was at that time. By the time I knew him. He was already very important to a lot of people. I mean, he'd been a mainstay of Chicago and world improv because he was one of the early people of the Second City.
Did you feel the power? You say he wasn't a guru to you. How did you take him in? Just as a teacher? You didn't develop?
I think I would like to have spent more time with him because especially as someone who's looking for a father figure, I think I would like to have spent more time with him.
Yeah, I don't hear that a lot in your story, you know, like talking to you that, you know, you would assume that you would be looking for a father figure. Did you find them?
No, brother figures.
Mm.
I found, because I also lost my two brothers at the same time. So I found a lot of brother figures.
Right.
You know, Paul Danilo is a brother figure. John Stewart is a brother figure.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, so those were deep emotional relationships. Still,
yeah.
That's nice.
And so I fell in love with improvisation.
Yeah.
Then there's something about it. I saw the first night I went there. There were teams, you know, improv teams, and this improv team was called Barons Barracudas. And if somebody was a Chicago improv person in the '80s, they know exactly. There was sort of a legendary group of people, amazing people on that. And the person I most admired was a guy named Dave Pasquese.
I work with Dave.
Okay,
so, he's still there. He's an actor.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he's still a friend of mine. But I saw Dave on stage and I immediately went, who is that? What is his secret? What does he have inside his mind that I want to know? Like, as a performer, not like I didn't admire him as a performer, though I did. What I meant is that I would see him on stage and go, he's got a secret. I'm waiting for his character to reveal his secret. There was some sort of vibe I got from him. There was always a little bit more that he wasn't sharing that was very interesting and made everything he did seem interesting and sort of like... like he's just about to open a door to some inner thought of his. And I admired him. I still do. I still kind of want to be Dave Pasquese because I admire improvisers so much and he's the best one I know. And so I saw him and I saw a bunch of other people in Chicago and I did that for a couple of years. I improvised in Chicago for a couple of years while I was still at school.
With a company?
With a group I formed with some friends at Northwestern called the No Fun Mud Piranhas.
Yeah.
And Schwimmer was one of them. And we we would go downtown and perform at Cross Currents. And that was my first taste of professional comedy life.
Yeah.
And I loved it.
And how'd you meet with, how'd you meet Sedaris and those crew?
When I got out of college, I formed a theater company for 1 year, which disappeared in a hail of, you know, blood and bones. It just didn't last.
Mm-hmm.
And then I traveled for a long time, and then I came back to Chicago with not a penny. I mean, not a penny in my
pocket. Where'd you travel?
All over Europe. I got a job working at a theater festival, in an arts festival in Italy called the Spoleto Festival, the Festival dei Due Mondi. And I was a voce recitante. I was a reciting voice with orchestras. I did Enoch Arden by Tennyson with Paolo Bordoni on the piano, playing this music by Strauss. I did Ferdinand, the Monroe Leaf story, with a little chamber orchestra.
Did you go to the Vatican?
I did, but this was not that part of Italy.
Oh.
And so I did that for a while, and then I just traveled around Europe just to not come home because I had no career and I had no money, and so I just slept on the side of the road.
This in your mid-20s?
23.
Uh-huh.
And then I came back when I was still 23, and a friend of mine, I had no place to live. I had no job. I had nothing. Not a dollar.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine was the box office manager at Second City. And she said, well, if you want to answer phones here, you know, I can pay you, you know, $8 an hour or whatever it was. And so I went and answered the phones with a guy named Jeff Garlin.
Yeah.
He was one of the other phone answerers.
Answering the phone loudly.
He would say, look at this. And he would pick up the thing and you'd have like 12. Second City was always sold out. There'd be like 12 lights lit up of people waiting in line.
Yeah.
And he would go, release, 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 release. They would all be on hold. And he would release all of them just to see their little lights disappear.
The power.
The power. And so then I started taking classes there.
Yeah.
Because you could take classes for free if you worked there.
Yeah.
So I was a part-time worker where they still let me take classes. And I mean, you can find online, there's pictures of my first day at Second City. They take a Polaroid of you against a wall. There's my day, Amy's day, Carell's day, though he was a little bit ahead of me, Danilo. And we were like all early, mid-20s people, not knowing what to do with our lives, kind of misfits. But Second City is kind of a misfit junction.
And then you were in the Annoyance too?
I did that with, I did a couple of things with Mick Napier
at
Annoyance. But I mostly just did Second City. And I had sort of been, Second City got bad-mouthed by the pure improv people in Chicago. But I found out that they were great. Everybody was there trying to make people laugh. And God, there was a paying audience every night. And you could experiment all you wanted in the improv set. And then you would craft it. You know, you'd learn a little bit something about dramatic structure.
Yeah.
To be able to make your sketches and make the scenes, though we never called it sketches, we only called it scenes.
Yeah.
Scene work. And I fell in love with the place. And then I made my career there for the next 4 or 5 years, actually.
And then you had the breakdown.
Breakdown was after that. Breakdown was after I had already, yeah, breakdown was toward the end of that. I got married. Yeah, I was 29. I had the breakdown. I remember I was in such a deep panic attack all the time that I'd be backstage. You know, because you still got to do a show. Still do 8 shows a week.
Sure.
And so I'd be backstage on a couch like that, but much rattier than the couch in here. And I'd be curled up in a ball, just lying on there with my like face kind of tucked in the corner of the couch so I didn't have to talk to anybody.
Just free-floating anxiety? Or like, what was it?
I don't know. My skin was on fire. I don't know how to describe it.
Yeah.
I think what's horrible about panic attacks, and again, God help me, this is the only really one I've ever had, is that it? After a while, it didn't become about anything.
Right.
It was just itself. It was just on you, like
dread.
Dread, like existential dread.
Yeah, worse.
Never be happy again. Yeah. And why would you ever have been happy? And nothing you ever want will ever come to pass. And every choice you've ever made is the wrong one. Like a terrible, debilitating, a truly mental illness.
How'd you get through it?
Well, I started off with some Xanax, but I did that for a week.
Yeah.
And I said, I could feel that the gears were still spinning, and what Xanax
just
had done
made them go slow.
No, it had thrown a insulated blanket over the gearbox,
right.
So I couldn't hear them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But I could sure still smell that smoke.
Yeah.
Coming out of that gearbox.
Right.
So I stopped, and then I mean, it came on me again like an animal. It was a hard thing to go off to,
right?
Because I knew it would come back really hard, and what really got over it was that I did it for months and months and months. I'd be backstage. I'd hear my cue to go on stage coming up, and I would kind of uncurl,
right,
like the alien at the end of Alien, how it stashed itself in the side of the escape pod with Sigourney Weaver, and it kind of uncurls itself and comes out. I would do that. I would untangle my limbs and go on stage, and I'd feel fine on stage.
That's what, yeah, of course. And that is the moment where you realize this is the best thing I do in my life. Thank God for this. Is where you're like, it happened to me late in life where I'd walk on stage before the show,
yeah,
just to feel it, and I'll be like, I know what this is.
Mm-hmm.
I know what happens here.
It actually scared me a little bit though.
Yeah.
Because I thought, oh, if I'm not on stage, like I'm helpless in a way.
Yeah.
And it made stage feel like a drug to me a little bit.
What's wrong with that?
Well, there are times when you're not on stage is the problem. And then one morning I woke up and the feeling was gone.
A gift. And I
couldn't understand why until I realized, oh, this is the first day of rehearsals for the new show. Mm. And what that means at Second City is you're not going in to do material. You're going in to create material and rehearse it as you create it. You're basically improvising all day long for months with the other cast members.
Living in the present.
Constantly in the moment of creation,
right.
8 hours a day,
right.
You know, 5 days a week, and then you're still doing the shows at night. It's very taxing. And then you slowly take that material and you switch out.
And that never went away. I mean, that never came back.
No, that was it. I hadn't even done it yet. I just knew I had the opportunity that day to improvise all day long.
Yeah.
And the feeling and the deep panic and the skin on fire went away. And I thought to myself, well, I guess I'm doing the right thing for a living because it's going to save my life.
But at some point, is this like now this is where I got to fast forward because you got a day to have. Now, at some point, though, is that the role that Faith began to play in your life a bit? Did that like
Faith happened before that? Faith happened before that. I was just walking down the street in Chicago and handed me a Gideon Bible, handed me a New Testament, Proverbs and Psalms.
And that's when it came back?
And I just opened it up and there's a little thing in the front of it, the table of contents in the little pocket Bible they gave me just had things to thinking about this, try this scripture, and it just said anxiety. And so I opened up, it said, go to Matthew chapter 5, and that's the Sermon on the Mount. And I read the sermon, and I was suddenly struck with the idea that, you know, the phrase, like, it spoke to me?
Yeah.
It really didn't feel like I was reading. It felt like it was literally speaking off the page. There was no effort at all. And what's great about the New Testament is that even when I had no faith at all, the words of Christ always had a very special feeling. Not like, and then he went to, Capernaum and healed them. None of that. Literally what he says.
Yeah.
And sermon is that chapter after chapter of just Jesus
talking
and giving you advice. So I say to you, do not worry.
Yeah.
For who among you by worrying can change a hair on his head or add a cubit to the span of his life? Don't. Stop. And it changed my life. And at a moment of revelation there, and I've never been the same.
Now, since we have this time, since I am apparently didn't pace myself properly.
Yeah, I'm sure I threw logs on the railroad
this is,
tracks.
But this was
interview.
Your trick.
It is.
Why you were going to dance around you.
I just rope a dope you, baby.
I know,
I
man.
Just rope a dope
That's
you.
What I figured would happen.
Uh-huh.
I don't feel like that. A couple questions. Starting with, you know, with politics, like that in the 2006, the dinner.
Oh, the correspondence dinner, yes.
Like that was, to me, like I thought that was a phenomenally ballsy, crazy, you know, insanely beautiful thing that happened. But a good deal of the culture didn't receive it that way in terms of like, you know, they misunderstood that.
And even the part of the culture that actually did receive it with its intention didn't do so for a couple of days because who was watching C-SPAN back then? And these dinners weren't necessarily cultural events the way that they have become now, especially since the resistance.
Well, I think you've frightened all Republican presidents from here forward for ever doing it, which is fine.
YouTube was brand new at the time.
Right.
And it was one of the first. That dinner was sort of received by people once they saw it on YouTube.
When you were doing it, did you know what was happening? Did you know that, like, you know, that you, I guess my question is, when you went up there as that character, were you just confident in your jokes or did you realize?
I was confident in the jokes, yeah.
But did you realize that, it immediately the vulnerability of that particular president and the people that knew him, it was going to take the turn it did?
No, I did not. Well, first of all, as you can attest to, if things aren't properly mic'd, the people watching on TV at home don't know what the room's like at all.
Yeah.
And the room actually wasn't as dead as it seems like on air, because there's one mic and it was pointed at my face. Mm-hmm. And so it had to be a giant laugh for you to hear it at all.
Right.
There were some good laughs in there.
Good.
Now, but there were also some delightful silences.
Right.
Very respectful silences at various times. Yeah. And I could tell that the man himself on my right was not enjoying it.
Oh, yeah. You felt that.
I only looked at him once or twice, the whole thing. And I thought to myself, I'm going nowhere near that man. Because I actually had one joke that I cut.
Yeah. Which was?
It was this man, because he recently had been criticized for giving away medals of freedom.
Yeah.
To people like George Tenet.
Yeah.
People who had completely shanked the Iraq War were getting medals of freedom as they were being ushered out the door because they were such disasters.
Yeah.
And I said, this man gives out medals of freedom like they're candy. No one ever gives him anything.
Yeah.
Well, that ends tonight. And I gave him a certificate. I had a certificate of presidency.
Yeah.
We made it look like something you get at the Learning Annex.
Yeah.
You know, fancy but cheap. Mm. And it was a certificate of presidency, and it said, this certificate indicates that I, Stephen Colbert, and I wrote it all in with my left hand, so which I did, Stephen Colbert acknowledges that George W. Bush is president of the United States. And I dated it, and I signed it and everything, and it was going to be like, give this to your mom. Put it up on the fridge, you know? Here's a little something for your mom. So anyway, I loved that. I mean, listen, I could tell that there were some things that there was, there was like just a whiff of brimstone in the room.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize that it was going to turn into anything.
Right.
I didn't really care how the people on the dais responded. Of course, I'm making jokes about them.
Yeah.
Or even the front row, like who were all people whose jobs depended on the people on the dais.
Right.
But it was playing pretty well to the back of the
all
room.
Right. Well, good.
And it wasn't until the next day that I realized that it had turned into a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
As my executive producer, Tom Purcell, said, look, we were throwing bottles of grape knee-high, albeit with a burning rag in the neck.
Yeah.
We weren't really throwing Molotov cocktails.
Right.
We were just pretending.
Right.
And he goes, what we didn't know was that the room was soaked with gasoline.
Right.
The room was on fire, you know, by itself. So I was there to make, I was hoping the president would laugh. Really?
Yeah, I know.
I even wrote him a letter saying, like, I hope you enjoyed it. I mean, maybe you didn't,
did he?
But I wasn't.
Did he get?
I don't know. Legally, I think he has to receive it.
So now, like, because, you know, the evolution of the show and how it started, the show you're on now.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, kind of was finding your footing.
And yeah, then no idea.
Trump, and they, right. And
publicly then not having any idea is what we did.
And Trump, like, as awful as it is,
yep.
You know, people rely on you to be a foil to this.
Mm-hmm. I rely on going to do it so I can express how I feel about it, you know.
So how do you feel on a day-to-day basis? Are you terrified? Are you angry? Because I know that I, like, especially lately, I'm becoming a bit hopeless.
Oh. Yeah, I'm not hopeless because we're entering into a new cycle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for the last 2 years, there really has been no story. I mean, there have been individual tragedies or individual triumphs happening that in this sort of the national conversation. I don't want to say news, but like what people are talking about, because I don't do news, but I do what people are talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I just said do.
Yeah.
But that's going to change now because we're going into a new presidential campaign. And he will, at a certain point, the president will only be 50% of what people are talking about.
Right.
They'll be talking about his competition, you know, all in reference.
You think
to him.
He's going
to
let that happen?
I don't think he has a choice. I actually think there's one nice thing about our constitutional democracy is that the necessity of the election will balance out.
And you think the democracy is going to hold up?
Yeah, sure. I do. I don't think it'll disappear in our lifetime.
Okay.
I mean, obviously it can.
Yeah.
It can. But I think that the 2018 elections show you that people do give a shit.
And also,
you know, that people are capable of shock and change. And that actually, I was pretty depressed before the 2018 election.
Yeah.
And then once it actually happened, I went, this will be interesting. There'll be some level of pushback and change here. And that's always hopeful. Any amount of change. Like if you can't have any change at all, that's when things get hopeless. And there's clearly change is possible.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear you think that. And a lot of people listen to you. I just read some article about this extensive survey about when you and John left the airwaves, that voting in a certain age group went down. That, you know, even if you weren't informing them, you were making them aware enough that they had to vote.
Oh my
you know,
God.
Yeah. So
oh
know
God.
That you carry that.
Okay, good.
You make
good
sure
to know.
You
Thank
make
you.
Sure you get them out. To vote.
Do you know how much John and I used to talk about, like, we're not here to actuate the youth vote?
Really?
Because people want you to be people want you to be an activist. If you talk about politics, they can't imagine you would talk about it and not be an activist, not want to be a playa. Like when we did our rally on the mall, no one could conceive that we could possibly want to talk about politics without wanting to be political players.
But it's tricky.
Yeah, absolutely not at all. As I said to John, like, you know, as it says at the end, near the end of The Lord of the Rings, when they're trying to figure out what to do, you know, how to destroy Sauron, Gandalf says it hasn't entered into Sauron's like wildest dreams that we would want to destroy the ring. They think we want to use it. I just said, you're like, why do they think we want to be political players?
Yeah.
All we do is make fun of these people.
Well, you kind of know you are.
No, I don't know that I am.
Hmm.
If I was a political player, Donald Trump would not be president.
Well, I mean, I'm just saying that, you know, people listen to you and people are scared.
No, you can say that people can say that you influence them.
Yeah.
And that's fine. Yeah. I've said this before. If people say that I influence them,
but
that's entirely their judgment. My intention is to do the jokes.
Okay.
And so if your intention is to do that, then you're not a political player.
Right.
People can say you talk about politics. People can say you influence how they think about politics. But your intention has to be to play with this thing, to control or to change.
Right.
And your intention is everything. People's interpretation is none of my damn business.
Okay. I'll let that be.
You're nothing if not a gracious host.
Thanks for talking to me, pal.
Oh, I really enjoyed it. We never even got into our history.
It's all right. That's all right.
Air America, rise up!
Yeah, is it back? Is it back? Can I get the job
right now?
Back?
Just today.
Can I
just
get
today.
The job
this
back?
This is Air America. Right. I got to leave here and go over to Maddow Studio and then Al Franken's.
We did all right.
All right.
How'd you feel about it?
Did I
get anything new?
Yeah, you did actually.
Oh, good.
You got some new stuff. Because my publicist, Carrie Bialik, the great Carrie Bialik, who's actually a manager now. She said, I'll listen. And, you know, I always enjoy it if you've said something you haven't said before.
Yeah.
And I know for a fact, I'm walking out the door. She goes, oh, you never said that thing about the thing.
Oh, good.
So you got a few new things in there.
Well, thanks, buddy. Thanks for talking.
Thank you. Bye.
Wow. That was, we got in it, right? Just off and running. I have no instrument. Me and Johnny Flynn played some guitar, a couple of 12 strings. Hung out for, you know, half hour or so in between takes, did some blues, did some talking. We've been talking a lot about music, man. A lot about music. It's great. It's great. All kinds of new things going into my head. New ways of looking at things. Boomer lives!
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.